Welcome to Keyframe on the Geek Show Podcast Network. I'm Tucky.
Yes, I'm Rob.
And I'm scared. Lewis.
Hello, Lewis. Yeah, I'm not sure what that hello there was either.
Hello!
Not sure what that one was either.
I can't just say.
I'm uncreative. I stole that from someone on YouTube, but it's so funny.
See, when you said that, all I had in my head was General Wilmer going, "Dogs are dangerous!"
Is this this one guy is just like... Every time he's introduced as a guest in his friend's video, he has to yell "Hello" at the top of his lungs. It's brilliant.
See, the way he says that, it makes him sound like he's greeting a 6 month old baby. Hello,
hello,
hello there. Oh, it's coochie coochie.
I don't know. It's supposed to be. I don't know, just their Britishness, I guess.
That's not British. That's just like, you know, your brain has melted because of the cuteness of a six-month-old baby. And you just standing there going, oh, he's a cutie.
If you hear the original, it sounds less like that. It's probably just me screwing it up. It's because he actually yells, but I don't want to yell. I just want to give the impression that I'm yelling.
I appreciate you not yelling. My ears are covered in headphones because I'm producing at the same time. I appreciate you not yelling.
Just like when he doesn't do it, it's like, what's wrong, Matthew? Like, everyone's going to complain that you haven't blown their ears out. Like, what was that? But yeah.
Yes. Anyway, let's move on, shall we? Starting off with the first bit of news, which is a bit of an odd duck, this, right? Tokyo's Toshima Ward. There was an apartment building called Tokiwaso that was demolished in 1982 because it was so run down. And it fallen into disrepair. But now the South Nagasaki neighborhood is actually having that apartment block, Tokiwaso, rebuilt as it originally was. Because so many people have been going to that spot as kind of, I don't know, you might call it a pilgrimage. Just so many manga fans have been going there for one particular reason. Tokiwaso was the home of Shotaro Ishinomori, who is the creator of the Kamen Rider manga, Fujiko Fujio, who's the creator of Doraemon, Fujio Akatsuka, who's the creator of Tensai Bakabon. But there's one other person, which is one of the main reasons why there's so many people going to Tokiwaso as a kind of pilgrimage. Osamu Tezuka lived there as well. So you have, in one place, it's as if here in the UK, you had Charles Dickens, one of the Bronte sisters, Jane Austen, and Shakespeare all happened to live in the same house, right?
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
It's basically on that scale, so I'm just kind of... I mean, Tezuka is the father of manga, the father of modern manga.
Mm.
The godfather of modern manga.
It's if they stayed in the same room sort of thing. Yeah, just imagine walking in there and they've just found this inspirational note from the previous owner.
Yeah.
It's like, right... Japanese Saturday mornings will never be the same.
Do you know the weird thing, though? I'm looking at the design of this Tokiwaso and everything like that, and it is typical old-school Japanese apartment building type thing, right? The model for it anyway. And they're going to rebuild it as it originally was. And obviously, in the rooms, they'll have like a manga studio, a mock-up of a manga studio type thing. As maybe Tezuka or Shotaro Ishinomori or someone like that would have used it. So that's fine. But I'm looking at it, and for some reason, in my head, I've got the Hiramari Sketch theme tune playing.
It does kind of look like it, doesn't it?
Just kind of... Do you see what I mean? Because it's a bunch of artists in an apartment block.
Yeah.
Honestly.
It's got to be like a national treasure of sorts now. I mean, that much talent in that small space.
Well, yeah, I mean, Kamen Rider is international now.
Yep.
You know, Doraemon, who hasn't heard of Doraemon?
I haven't.
They've just released it like in America as well, haven't they? So,
well,
the whole dub on Disney Channel of sorts.
Anime's getting popular in America.
Back when we were...
As much as possible.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, back when we were on community radio, right next door to the station was a little corner shop. And this is in the middle of nowhere, right? This is in the middle of nowhere important, which is why it's just down the road.
I was going to say it's nearer to where I live.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, you know the place, the Geo Food Store, just down Victoria Road.
The blue one, yeah.
The blue one, yeah. Yeah. They were selling Doraemon toys, official Doraemon toys.
Official ones?
Yes.
Why?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know how they ended up there. I don't know why they were selling them, but they were selling them.
Some of own bargains, plasticine.
Well, I don't know. Actually, maybe it makes sense. Kind of like Dragon Ball Z cards. Those were a thing at one point.
Yeah, but the thing is, shops. I couldn't walk into a random Asian themed shop.
Mm.
By Asian, I mean Indian subcontinent, right? Mm. Selling fruit and vegetables and foods of India,
yeah, that's
Pakistan,
true.
And Bangladesh.
Very much about selling fresh, you know, cooking stuff.
Yeah, I couldn't walk into a shop like that and suddenly find Dragon Ball Z cards.
Yeah.
But I did walk into Geo and find little Doraemon toys.
Yeah.
We also found camel balls there, which were, you know, a cream-filled and extra sour.
Don't go about it. You'll outrage parents.
Nice.
It's actually Wonderful. A sweet called camel balls. It's actually like a boiled sweet.
The thing is, it's been out for years, and one mother takes it to a local paper, and all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, yeah, this is a bit rude, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it doesn't offend everyone, but it offends me. Stop triggering me.
Yeah. Tokiwa Zoo is getting rebuilt in South Nagasaki, Hanasaki Ward Park, and it's only going to be about 200 meters away from where it originally was. Yeah, it was torn down in 1982, found its repair. In the years since, the address has become a tourist destination for manga fans. The reconstructed Tokiwa Zoo will be built in South Nagasaki, Hanasaki Ward Park, which is only about 200 meters away from where the original building was. So it's not going to be built where the original building actually was. So it's going to be more like a museum place type thing.
Sort of like Baker Street,
221B, yeah.
Where in London, where you just walk in and it's like, oh, look, it's all Sherlock Holmesy.
Yeah, but it's not actually 221B Baker Street because that never existed.
Fictional.
Yeah. The original Tokiwa Zoo was about 420 square meters, big with two stories, and the ward is going to hold meetings with manga artist Machiko Satonaka, who is the creator of Karyodo no Seiza, and there are other manga artists who are also going to be involved, and they have knowledge of the apartment because they live there. Friends and family of the residents, they envision a museum space showcasing the work environment of Japan's struggling early manga artists, which I think is a great idea.
There's a lot of struggle and a lot of cramped living conditions, like kind of like a sweatshop, a one-man sweatshop.
Well, Yukio Takano, the ward chief, called the apartment the holy ground for Japan's manga and anime culture, which it can now boast of around the world.
Billion-pound industries.
Yeah.
Forged in one little spot.
Well, this is the thing. I mean,
it's quite humbling when you think about it.
Yeah. When you think about it, I mean, most of these industries had really humble beginnings. I mean, if you look at cinema, for example, the movie industry had really humble beginnings, starting off with just this piece of odd technology that no one really understood. And then you had creators, visionaries like Georges Méliès, who pretty much single-handedly created special effects.
Mm.
When you get right down to it.
When you look at like beginnings staying in Japan, like the first home of Nintendo.
Yeah.
You say that's just a little building and used to just be trading cards.
Well, yeah. Not trading cards, just playing cards. There was the Hanafuda cards and stuff like that, and Karata and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's what they made.
See where that is now. It's on everyone's phone.
Yeah. And so humble beginnings, you know.
Things like that seem to truly last, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of pop culture and being remembered by people.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those odd things here in this country. We have all those blue plaques that go around, oh, so-and-so lived here, or so-and-so was born here.
I don't know those.
No, they're terrible.
Have you not seen them?
Just to the side.
You're from London. You must have seen the blue plaques on the side of the building saying, so-and-so lived here.
Probably.
Yeah, you're not know who they are.
Down, like, the kind of places that I imagine that have that, I'm not looking at the houses and stuff. I've got somewhere to be.
Yeah. No, they started putting them up around the country now, outside of London.
Insignificant places. Yeah.
Maybe I've seen them, but I didn't really know what they were.
You'll probably know them when you see them. It's a little circular blue plaque.
I think I know what you mean, actually.
And it just says, oh, so, you know, Charles Dickens lived here during the summer of 1877 or something like that.
Okay, I've seen those ones.
That thing's like Michael Jackson spilled the soda here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting to that scale.
Well, if you get Pokemon Go, you'll find them all Pokestops now.
It used to be that it was only, like, this person actually lived here and worked here for most of their life. And that was fine. Oh, this person was born here. So William Shakespeare, for example. Oh, yeah, William Shakespeare was born in this building or on this street. You're like, okay, right. This is the street that William Shakespeare was born on.
Mm.
Fine. That's worthy of a blue plaque. But then saying, you know, there's a restaurant down the road saying, William Shakespeare once spilled pasta on his tights.
Yeah, the thing is, like, about, like, oh, someone lived here, is that I'm sure, like, if these people were successful, like, they probably lived in a lot of places. Like, you...
It's lived and worked.
Every single place they lived.
Yeah.
It's a bit much.
Well, I mean, Tucky said it best. He said, if this was in this country, this building would have been wrapped in cellophane and covered in blue plaques.
I mean, it probably would have been torn down, to be honest. <It's> disrepair? No housing shortages in Britain.
No. No, not at all. Anyway, moving on to the second news story. There's very little in the way of news this week, so and there's no trailers. So we struggled, but we found another bit of news.
Scraped around a bit. Yeah.
Well, this one actually kind of screamed at us, you know, talk about me. You must talk about me, because you talked about me last week. Because you remember last week we were talking about the Bungaku Free Market and Shosetsuka Ninaro competition. Right?
Oh, yeah.
That band stories that had the theme of traveling to alternate worlds or being reincarnated into other worlds. Right? Well, another contest didn't actually enforce a similar ban. That contest was the fourth Nut Novel Prize, and it kind of makes it more understandable why the Bungaku Free Market and Shosetsuka Ninaro competition actually put that ban into place in the first place. Because when you look at the results... Of the 46 winning stories in the Net Novel Prize, right, this is on the contest's website, 14 of them, that's over a quarter of them, have the words alternate world directly in the title.
So that's just the ones that reference it in the title, not like all of them that are necessarily about that.
So if you imagine that, if that's just the ones that are referencing it, the ones that don't actually reference it in the title but actually are about it, you might even be looking at half the stories that were entered into the competition.
Yeah.
You know, it could go as high as that. We don't know. But anyway, some examples. The Unparalleled Saint Salaryman and the Road to Surviving in an Alternate World. Alternate World Station Cafe. Alternate World Brothel Manager.
Topper.
Yeah. They wanted to go with Alternate World Pimp, but they couldn't. Or Alternate World Long-Legged Mac Daddy. See, if they went with alternate world long leg back daddy, that one would have won. I would have voted for that one. But anyway, item collector in an alternate world. The alternate world's magic language looks just like Japanese, because it always looks like Japanese. Doing my best to pet fluffy things in an alternate world. Not sure what fluffy things it's trying to pet. Or
ferrets.
Yeah. The first placed grand prize, which included publication of the story and a 1 million yen prize, which is about $10,000, or just under $10,000, was won by a story about traveling to an alternate world titled The Chronicle of the Male Virgin Who Travels to the Alternate World Chirem, which is a combination of cheat and harem, and gains healing magic.
So that one won. Like... Given that that's the one that won, and these are, like, the top 46, like, I guess they're serious, but these titles sound like jokes, a lot of them.
It does not sound like a serious, like, kind of contest.
Yeah.
It's like, my entry for the alternate world where I end up in Sainsbury's and get done for shoplifting in aisle 4. make top 10.
Yeah. All I can say is that it is coming off trend in anime where you have these light novel translations, these adaptations of light novels dealing with alternate worlds. So you have stuff like Sword Art Online, Konosuba, Log Horizon Gate, ReZero is the big popular one from last season. I think it was voted the number one anime of spring 2016. ReZero starting life in another world, right? But there's loads of others. Half the manga that I've suggested to you, Tucky, has been going to an alternate world. And the thing is, there are much better stories than the ones that they've got listed there on that Net Novel Prize. that deal with transport to another world. Arafureta, for example, is a much better story than anything they've got listed there.
There's a whole other world of other worlds out there.
Tensei Shitara Slime Dataken is a much better story than that. The guy is reincarnated in another world as a slime.
First chapter, he eats a dragon.
There's another one on that, which is, Kumo Desuka Nanika, I think it's called, which is where the whole class is killed, and kind of the wallflower of the class is reincarnated in a labyrinth as a spider, kind of the lowest of the low, and has to eat her way to the top.
That's dark.
Yeah, it is pretty dark.
Oh, it's British politics. It was.
Basically. Yeah, and you've got so many stories like that. You've got Death Marching to the Parallel World Rhapsody, which is 14 volumes long at the moment and still going. And it's basically a slice of life about the guy going around. He's basically become like crazy. He's basically like a god, and yet he's a tourist. His main job is tourist.
Just to see what other people are like. I think that's a pretty I think that's probably the most sensible thing you can do as a god, actually.
Yeah.
Go around, explore the world, and find out what is actually going on in other people's heads.
Just like Doctor Who.
There's loads of others. There's loads of others that I can mention. I've read loads of these transported to another world, reincarnated in another world stories, and it's just... One of the best is one called Seiyun no Kakara, which is... It's actually kind of post-Stone Age, pre-Iron Age time. So everybody's still tribal, everyone's still kind of hunter-gatherer type people. And he's kind of a modern blacksmith who's sent back in time to that era. And he has to try and make the best of it because he doesn't know how to get back to his own time. So it is technically transported to another world because everything is so very different to what he's used to. There's no running water. You know, people have only just discovered how to make fire and stone weapons, stuff like that. You see? So there is some thought going into some of these, and they don't have, like, an alternate world brothel manager.
I can't, it's like, how can you get away with that?
Yeah, I'm wondering that as well, but maybe it's a secretly very, very good plot, but...
Transport to Germany during the World Cup of 2014.
There's others. There's one that's called So What If It's an RPG World, which actually isn't a bad story.
So basically Sword Art Online.
Well, not quite, because...
Well, that was the premise of the first Sword Art Online, essentially.
Essentially, it was the premise of the first Sword Art Online, except everyone was transported to a virtual world. So what if it's an RPG world is literally they are transported to a world where everything works as if it's an RPG. They even have status screens and stuff like that. Everybody has them, even the NPCs.
Wait, so is it more Sword Art Online or Danmachi? I don't know.
It's kind of a little bit in between both.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So it's not an actual VR MMO. They're actually taking to another world where the rules are, you know, these things are like that. The NPCs. Oh,
okay, so it's more Danmachi. I assumed from the title it was more like because of how Kirito and Asuna never actually met each other.
Yeah.
And then there was kind of like, but it's not real, I don't know.
Yeah, there's loads of them like that. Magi Craftmeister is an interesting one. Legend is an interesting one. The guy's body gets reconstructed directly out of magic. Magi Craftmeister is just a guy gets killed in an accident at a factory, and because he's actually quite skilled at making stuff, he gets resurrected. His soul gets taken away from the cycle of reincarnation and resurrected as a magic being. That's it. And he inherits the knowledge of a master craftsman, a master magic craftsman who's, you know, been missing, who's disappeared 1,000 years before. So, yeah, stuff like that. There's so much more there. And then there's Magi's grandson, which is just, yeah. I'm not sure what to make of that. I feel sorry for the grandparents in that one.
Yeah, but the grandparents are cool.
The grandparents are cool. It's just Magi's grandson is the guy. The guy is reborn in another world in the body of a baby, right? And he gets picked up by this old man who just happens to be the strongest wizard in the world, right? But the problem with him is that he starts teaching the kid some little bits of magic because the kid's aware of what's going on because he's a reincarnated person. And he's picking up magic really quickly. So the old man is like, oh, he's really pleased. He thinks he's a great teacher. So he starts teaching him more magic, not thinking, hang on, I should put the brakes on a little bit. So what he ends up doing is teaching this kid way more than the kid actually needs to know. So the kid ends up a bit like his granddad, a bit of a monster when it comes to magic. And everyone's kind of going, yeah, your granddad, he's like a big hero. He defeated demons, everything like that. He's like, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I killed a couple of demons. Oh, you're a hero as well. Like, no, I'm not.
Hero
I'm
just of justice.
Thing is, his grandma, who, because his grandma and his granddad and his grandma, they both taught him all sorts, and he's been taught how to use the sword by one of the best sword masters in the world. But because they live out in the countryside, in the middle of nowhere, he has no idea who any of these people really are. There's like kings who come to visit his granddad because his big granddad's a big hero, and he still has no clue. His granddad and grandma saved an entire country like 30 years before, and they're still worshipped as heroes. There's plays about them and all sorts, and they hate going to that country because everybody just hangs on their every word.
Mm.
It's the other side of being like a really popular hero, where you just have groupies following you everywhere. Like now. Right, okay, so shall we take a break there?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be back in a minute with some animation. And I call it animation rather than anime this week because we have just general animation.
Hey, so films, those are certainly things, right? And if you want to listen to much better film analysis than that, listen to Cinema Eclectica, also on the Geek Show Podcast Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back. And we're into some animation now. We're going to start off with Tucky.
This week, I have been watching X2. Or Shoo.
See, what a name.
When you say it like that, it sounds like a combination of Durarara and the second X-Men movie.
Durarara. Anyway, but...
X-Men.
I can't pronounce it properly. I'm sure I put a few extra ra's in there. But
Durarara. Just call it Durarara.
Durarara. It's only three ra's in it.
Yeah.
Right. So Durarara obviously had its first season. It was in some ways a really popular mainstream anime of the time, following the exploits of Mikado Ryugamine, who is like every day kid who turned out to be a gang leader of an internet. I don't know what you could say. Well, a gang leader of an internet gang.
Yeah.
Basically, the premise behind
that's
it
literally
was,
what it was, is a gang leader of a net gang.
He lives in Ikebukuro, which is a real place in Japan, and the designs actually are the exact same as the city itself. But he's best friend Masaru Kiro, who turns out to actually be the leader of the Yellow Scarfs, which is another faction gang. And it all came to a head where all the dollars met up and had this whole scuffle with the Yellow Scarfs, and people went their separate ways, and so it kind of ended on a really good note. And there's some supernatural thrown in there with the headless rider Celtie, who's also was it like a Doolahan, I believe they call it, like an
Is
Irish
it Celtie or Kelty?
Celtie.
Is it Celty? They yeah. actually pronounce it Celty.
It looks Kelty because, you know, Celtic, but which also goes back to the Doolahan thing, because Doolahan's like an Irish fairy kind of creature.
It's basically headless horsemen kind of thing.
And I say that they've kind of sexed up the headless horseman with a cute little cat-eared helmet and a big black leather suit.
And a motorbike.
Yeah. And it's... yeah. So anyway,
that scoops on the helmet.
So that's I mean, it makes fantastic cosplayers, and there's lots of different.
It makes easy cosplay.
Well, I kind of fit in the cat suit. You say the helmet doesn't fit ours, but it's this whole thing where it was really popular. Like I say, there was a lot of characters involved in it, and they managed to develop them in each little way. So I started watching the second season, and I thought to myself, well, where can they go from this? The big reveal was that Mikado was like the leader of the Dollars. Henri, the school friend, she's possessed by a demon blade of sorts. And obviously, Kido, he was the leader of the Yellow Scarfs. So going into season two, I had no idea what they would do with it. I was kind of expecting them to develop it more. But as soon as we get into it, they start throwing more characters at you, as if there wasn't enough. And we find out, what's his name? He's Aya, has two sisters who are slightly incestuous. There's other different bit part players, and further on they start adding more Russian mafia types in.
Well, is it turning into Black Lagoon?
It's a big hot mess. But like I say, they've got that many characters. They could have developed them. They could have stuck with them and went, right, then let's give them a bit more backstory.
I want to see the backstory of the guy who picks up motorbikes and throws them at people.
Well, his backstory is he's just freakishly
strong and angry and all the time. So he's basically
Shizuo Hirojima. He's got a famous brother who they bring into it more. I mean, we knew about this last season, that he's like a movie star and a bit crazy. And he's just basically, he tries to look after his brother. And they bring his brother into the second season, give him a psycho girlfriend who turns out to be a serial killer / superhuman of sorts. And they don't really play on that much, but mainly in the early episodes.
Yeah,
she's like a serial killer who calls herself Hollywood, and it's mainly because she does like the Hollywood effects and makeup, and she becomes these different characters. Like, I think it was shown on the news that a velociraptor, someone with a velociraptor head, just went on a murder spree, and it's her.
Okay.
So you get more of a supernatural feel on the earlier episodes going into it, but By the midway point, you're kind of numb to it. There's nothing new that could throw at you. I mean, that you're trying to get a grasp of all these characters, and the whole plot line kind of diverts back onto the first season, but then it goes completely off the rails and you lose interest. Well, I personally lost interest. And it was a shame because, like I say, I had huge hopes for this going forward, but they've oversaturated with too many characters, too many storylines going on. The plot was very thin on the ground.
Yeah.
There's room to develop it, but you're going to have to take about 6 seasons for it all to be developed properly. I mean, the following Selty, she plays a much bigger part in it because I think she was like the main draw of season 1. So they basically looked at it and went, we need more headless catsuit. And that'll sell more.
Okay.
That's all I can assume from it. Because it sticks Selty front and centre. There you go. And, I mean, she's even got a love interest. Don't know how it works. Don't really want to know how it works. Well, but it's really, from watching it, I'm disappointed in the direction that they've taken it. Because they could have built on the characters that they had initially, but they haven't. It's kind of rushed it. And have more characters. Here, have more. Just pile them on. And it's disappointing. It's a disappointing end for me. I mean, other people might find it like, yay. But there was nothing that really stood out. And to be honest, by about episode 20, 21, I was gone. I checked out. It was just background noise to work for me.
Yeah.
And it's disappointing because I like to watch it all the way through. But like I say, just background noise. Couldn't keep us interested. And it had nothing new. It was just like basically like really poorly recycled plot line. And I mean, even the fan service was the same. Very disappointing.
That's a shame.
It is. I say it could have done so much more.
Oh, well. Well, it's a shame. I mean, it's a hell of a fall from the first season.
Oh, definitely. Like I say, they had the whole, they've built it up, there's the dollars, there's gang warfare, there's a mystery supernatural element there, and then they've just ruined it with the second season. And I think there's going to be like DRRX3 or something like that, but what they're going to do, add another 30 characters and try and live on past glories again, I don't know. I can't watch on. It'll probably turn into something Russian mafia-y. Like, he's some other people from Russia that you don't care about. They've got nothing to do with the storyline, but look, Russians.
Yes.
And what can you do? What can you do? Look, they had something good and ruined it. They Brexited their own show.
Yeah, Selvis has left the building. All right, then, Lewis, then.
Okay, today I'm doing Fate Stay Night Unlimited Blade Works Part 2.
Okay.
Well, like, just to talk about what the series is about, is it basically revolves around the Holy Grail War, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is the battle royale between masters, normally proficient mages, and servants who are like heroes from across time that have been summoned to see who possesses the Holy Grail and gets a wish. And that's what was going on up till the end of part one. The second half of Unlimited Blade Works picks up exactly where part one left off, where something happens to the main character, Shiro Emiya, that affects his ability to participate, and he gets told by Rin to essentially get lost, don't get involved in the war.
Yeah.
But Shiro Emiya, being Shiro Emiya, goes, nope, I'm going to get involved because, you know, something important to him was sort of lost in the process. When part one ended, he was in a confrontation with the caster, essentially, and the caster had something above him and Rin. And Rin has returned to confront caster, and Shiro also decides to get involved. And from there, it's basically Shiro and Rin coming across all of the other, you know, servants and their masters, sometimes like not together but individually, and it's just like them fighting over ideals, I guess. They should call this Fate Unlimited Clash of Ideals, because that's what this is. All the conflict, whilst it's for the Holy Grail, a lot of people kind of have their own wishes that might come directly from the Holy Grail if they win, but in some cases it's just kind of like quite a lot of the characters aren't particularly interested in the Holy Grail and have just been sucked into this war because of unfortunate circumstances or whatever.
Yeah.
And this is what made the show really interesting for me. Like, for example, at the end of the first half, Caster was portrayed, I guess, as an antagonist, essentially. She was getting in the way of the main characters and was doing some stuff that was morally questionable. But through like some flashbacks and, you know, the relationship with her master, what was his name again? I've forgotten. Soichiro something or other.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. You sort of start to understand like what the participation in the war means to them. And one thing that I've sort of noticed is that the master was very passive because what I've noticed a lot about the show is that a lot of the people have extraneous circumstances way beyond what most human beings have, so their lives are completely different.
Yeah.
And it leads them to do things that are strange or morally questionable or whatever. But when the characters, the show's very good at giving enough development, enough personality, and enough exposition to make you understand every character, even the ones that are absolutely irredeemable, at least like their motivations have some sense. And in the case of Caster, like, all she sort of really wanted to do was go home. It seems that with a lot of the servants, because like their lives are sort of infinite, they just basically keep getting resummoned to fight in pointless wars under, you know, servants that are normally just really trashy people who want nothing but power, and it has an effect on them and their motives. And we sort of start to learn that Caster is just using sort of her magic to try and win the war. But I've noticed that if you look back, a lot of the things she's done and has avoided death and stuff.
Yeah.
So it made her quite sympathetic. But, you know, they defeat them. You know, they move on to other characters and just so much stuff happens. But I just feel like by explaining it, I'll ruin it. I really don't know what to say. But the main strength here is just how, like when you first start watching the first half, and I think this applies to Fate Zero as well. I was very overwhelmed by Fate Zero when I first started watching it. Like, it establishes the Holy Grail War. It establishes all the factors around it, like what the Holy Grail is, how magic works, by showing you like how magic is being used, all these things. And then you start off with a lot of information and a lot of characters that you don't understand. And as the story progressed in the first half, those threads branched out and started encapsulating all of these characters without really, you know, giving them exposition, but building on the main characters and stuff a bit. And now it's sort of like, well, like, it did give exposition to some of the characters that haven't shown up in this one, but now it's sort of like gone past that and it's broadened out and it's reached out to all these characters. It explains their motives, like, either through flashbacks or through conflict, and then sort of brings them all together as, like, they either get eliminated in the plot or their goal is achieved or fails or whatever. And then all of a sudden, every single thing in the series that has been mentioned, or every character that has been mentioned, has a purpose, has sense, has its place. And that's kind of how the plot progression is, because the plot itself is basically there's a Holy Grail war, have at it. That's the plot.
Yeah.
But it's really what made this show so good is like all the different characters, all of their different motives, the fact that everyone was not necessarily sympathetic, but if you allow yourself to truly believe the fact that these people have powers way beyond what normal people have, and their circumstances are so different beyond what normal people have, it makes every character empathetic to some extent. And like the plot is just sort of going through that. And I guess if we were to focus on the main character, because that's, you know, what this is about, I guess.
Well, like, yeah, I mean, the main characters would be Shiro and Rin, I suppose.
Yeah.
But also to a degree, Archer, I'd say, as well.
Yes, but...
But which Archer? Gilgamesh or Archer? Archer.
Well, I don't know. I was going to mention specific names. I was going to stick with Shiro Emiya for now.
Okay.
To focus on the main character, I guess, because I feel like there's aspects of him that I can talk about without it being a problem. Like, I guess he was, again, one of those people who ended up in the Holy Grail War by chance, I guess.
Well, yeah, it's more an accident than design that he ends up as part of the Holy Grail War.
But regardless, he's been fully participatory in it. And I guess all of this sort of leads to what he wants to be. He wants to be a hero of justice. And, you know, I think I mentioned this in the first part, but it basically came from the fact that he was saved from a disaster by Kiritsugu Emiya, who was someone who was involved in Fate Zero in a certain... I guess I might as well say, because it was at the beginning. He basically helped create the Holy Grail, in a sense.
Well, not so much that he helped create the
Holy Grail. Or at least in its current form.
Well, even in its current form, because the Holy Grail just appears as it does. Kiritsugu's idea in Fate Zero was to destroy the Holy Grail once and for all.
But he couldn't.
He couldn't, no. Because
so he decided to put it in a vessel that was more manageable, more reasonable, I guess.
In a sense, yeah.
Better hidden.
Well, technically that's right. But I mean, the problem with Kiritsugu's character, or rather, the tragedy of Kiritsugu's character, is that for all his high ideals, he didn't have the strength to accomplish his goals.
Well, yeah, I was going to go there, because that points directly to exactly what Shiro Emiya is as a person.
Yeah.
As I was saying, that was what he wanted to do, but things didn't necessarily go according to plan. But like after that, stuff happened. He saved Shiro Emiya from a disaster and started bringing him up. And as you said, that powerlessness, the reason why he tried to do what he did to the Holy Grail was essentially because he felt it was the right thing to do, and I guess would, you know, mitigate bloodshed. The point being is he couldn't do that. But he was able to save Shiro, and Shiro sort of saw, I guess, like what little hope there was from that. He managed to save someone from that disaster and blah, blah, blah. And he admired his ideals. And that's kind of where his ideals of being a hero of justice come from, even though he will never, or at least initially never really said it himself. And that seems to be like the driving motivation for the character. And it's quite interesting because he goes on and on about being a hero of justice, and he does really seem to believe in it. But at the same time, it's like, well, like, why? What's your purpose? How much do you really believe in it? Is it really you that believes in it? And throughout the story, like, because he's always had this conflict with Archer for some reason, and Archer always saw him as naive, like, you can't be a hero of justice and someone like you shouldn't exist. And like, as the story sort of progresses, they kind of butt heads more and more, and to the point that it becomes like an actual conflict, because Archer seems to want him dead for some reason, and his naivete is just something that he cannot stand. But like, through conflict, resolutions of sorts happen. And but as I said, like, the plot itself has things happening that I'm not getting into, but the story is about this sort of character development and this sort of progression. And like the first series, the fights are still really good. I mean, also, like, not only through Archer, he also becomes a stronger, I guess, in terms of like his powers, but also, like, I guess mentally through Rin as well, and he helps Rin to develop as well. So there's just so much characters playing off of each other. And again, as I said, I like to call this like Fate Unlimited Clash of Ideals, because a lot of the characters develop by fighting each other.
Yeah.
Like, obviously when you believe in something and you have that sort of power to fight, you kind of try and make those a reality through fighting the people that are at odds with you.
Oh, but yeah.
At the same time, all of the characters, like, they discuss what they believe in and how it manifests power in terms of a power, because it seems that a lot of powers, like in anime in particular, I noticed like a lot of magic, like the nature of magic and the strength of magic is based in the spirit. What you believe in will make your magic manifest a certain way, a certain strength. So it's really like a means of communicating with each other, but at the same time you get some really cool fights out of it, which are still really well animated and still have really cool special effects and stuff like that. But it's a really, really good show because the characters are like really deep. But yeah, like it has one of the best endings like in anime that I can sort of think of. Like there's no loose ends, but at the same time, after the events, it's kind of like, well, everything's sort of back to normal now. And it's interesting because that's kind of what life is like. You know, you go through big events, but do you change that much? Yes, you grow and you can face things differently, but you're still you.
Yeah.
Like the world keeps on turning, the sun keeps on burning. And after the massive thing that was the Fifth Holy Grail War, it's kind of like, it's pretty sort of humbling from an in-universe perspective. And it kind of makes you think of life that way as well. But yeah, and it just sort of shows what happens afterwards as well. But it's good as well because a lot of endings to anime and games, they kind of go, here's a space for a sequel, implying that something specific is going to happen.
Yeah.
This gives a really good platform for a sequel to happen. But it could turn out, if, say, for example, they don't do a sequel,
yeah,
the ending is such that nothing is happening now. So it's a very good sort of way of ending things. If they ended here, it'd be completely fine. If they needed a sequel, this is a good platform for it.
Okay.
So very, 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 very good ending. Very good characters, great animation, great fight scenes. I just wish I could just go full spoilers on everyone right now.
Yeah.
To explain exactly why it's good. Yeah, I just don't know what else to say, I guess.
Overall, a recommend then?
100%, yeah.
Fantastic. Right. So, my turn now, and I've got something completely different to the norm. For my next trick, I have an independent film. An independent stop-motion animated film. Who would have thunk? Yeah, I've got Anomalisa, which is directed by Duke Jones and Charlie Kaufman. Created by Charlie Kaufman. It's actually based originally on a stage play. And there's a nice little Q&A on this, because this is out from Curzon Artificial Eye. And it's not something that fits into our usual fare of animation, but it is animation. It's stop-motion animation, and it is amazing stop-motion animation. It is really beautifully animated. The characters, the world feels alive. The characters actually they feel alive. The animation detail is ridiculously good. You know how good stop-motion animation can be, right, when it's done really well. Well, this is stop-motion animation par excellence. It is that good.
Mm.
I would challenge Nick Park to do better. I would challenge Aardman to do better than this.
Well, is that good, then?
Yes, it is that good.
Like, Aardman is pretty much like the gold standard, I guess, for that sort of thing.
Anyway, it starts off with a middle-aged customer services expert called Michael Stone, right? And he is played by David Thewlis, and he goes to Cincinnati for a business meeting. He's basically giving a talk about a book he wrote about customer services, and he's staying in a hotel there. He's just got to Cincinnati, but on the flight there, because the film opens with this really nice side-on shot of just the sky and the plane flying, but it's all stop-motion still. Right, with a little bit of CG effects thrown in, obviously. And it goes to the inside of the plane, and you have this graying middle-aged character of Michael Stone, and he's reading a letter, which is from his ex, who we broke up with 10, 11 years before.
Mm.
And he's just seeing a picture of his ex, and his ex sounds quite mannish. It's obviously a woman, but sounds quite mannish in terms of the voice acting. And I think that's a purposeful thing.
Okay.
So anyway, he gets to Cincinnati. He doesn't want to really talk to anyone. The taxi driver is is a bit annoyed because he's quite non-committal. He's British, living in America. He's got a wife and a kid. And he asks the taxi driver if the taxi driver knows a toy store. Taxi driver gives him directions to a toy store. Turns out it's not the right sort of toy store. It's a different type of toy store that's open 24 hours a day, if you take my meaning. So
a late-night toy store.
Late-night toy store for sexy people and their sexy type.
Wait, what?
Yeah, not that sort of, not the toy store where you go to buy...
You can't say that out loud.
Yeah, it's not the type of toy store...
No, I knew.
Not the type of toy store where an eight-year-old boy dressed as a pirate wants to buy a toy from. So, anyway, that's all right. I haven't told you about Batman 66 meets Jonathan Steed and Mrs. Peel.
Oh, don't want to know.
Robin meets Mrs. Peel and she goes, full of vim and vigor, aren't you? He's like, oh, gosh.
Oh, golly.
So, anyway, so he's at this hotel. I think it's called the Filogi Hotel. And everything is just... as normal. He's kind of bored of everything. It feels like the character has reached a midlife crisis. And so he calls his ex, who he hasn't seen for like a decade. And she's kind of shocked that he's called her out of the blue. And he tries to explain that, you know, explain how he was feeling back then. So obviously he doesn't go well. She leaves in a huff. And he's... you know, he picks up an automaton, an antique Japanese thing from this toy store, and he's not sure what to do with it. He's going to give it to his kid because, you know, he thinks it's just a robot. He's not really your fair. It's a bit like, you know, if you have kids and your kid wants a Nintendo 3DS, but you buy them Game of Life instead. So anyway, he's kind of trying to work out what exactly he is all about, what exactly his life is all about. And he meets a young woman who's a big fan of his called Lisa. And the name Anomalisa is taken from a Japanese word that means goddess of heaven. And the whole thing with Lisa, he falls in love with the way she speaks, with her voice. And he thinks she has an amazing voice. And he just wants to listen to her talk because something in the way that she says things calms him down, makes him think that life isn't so bad. And okay, he's fallen quite hard for her, and the whole point of this film is that for that one brief day he met somebody who changed his life, but then after that he had to go back to his old grey life. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so the midlife crisis continues. There are bits in this where Kaufman and Jones have thrown in some bits of surrealism. There's one bit where he's just come out of the shower and he's looking at the mirror and all of a sudden his face starts acting up, and he gets into a bit of a panic, and then he hears this voice, and he runs. He gets changed quickly and runs at the corridor. He starts knocking on people's doors, saying, "Sorry, I'm looking for my friend. He's somewhere on this floor." And eventually, he meets Lisa that way.
Mm.
Lisa and her roommate, who are there to actually attend his talk. He obviously sleeps with Lisa, and then gets woken up by the hotel manager on the morning. Who he goes down to the hotel manager's office, which is in the basement. And the hotel manager says to him, you know, I don't mind that you're philandering, you know. He's like, well, who told you I was philandering? And he's like, well, I don't mind, you know, if you want to philander, that's fine, hey, whatever's good for you, but why can't you do it with me? And this is a guy saying this, and Michael's going, well, I don't understand what he's saying. He's like, well, why does it have to be Lisa? I love you too. And so Michael's going, I don't know what's going on anymore. I'm going to leave. Thank you. Bye.
Isn't a philanderer someone who plays specifically with women?
Yeah. But so. Anyway, Michael opens the door and there's this like typing pool area where you've got all these women. And so he's trying to make his way across and all the women are going, well, why don't you sleep with me, Michael? I'd have sex with you. You know, why does it have to be Lisa? And he's like,
What's happening?
One of those strange, surreal bits where you're not actually sure whether he's hallucinating or whether his brain is playing tricks on him or not. Because at the end of this, this culminates with him getting back to his floor and he accidentally bounces off one of the lamps on the wall and part of his face falls off.
I'm scared.
Right? Yeah. The bottom part of his face falls off to show just kind of a mechanical bit underneath. He picks it up and the face is still moving, so he puts it back on. He's like, and then he starts running down the corridor looking for Lisa because he's having a bit of a breakdown by this point.
Yeah.
So that all is done really quite well, but it does make you question what's going on.
Yeah.
It does really make you question what's going on.
Definitely, just from hearing it.
Now, the problem I've got with Anomalisa, right, there's a couple of things that you need to know about. Number one, they couldn't actually get this funded aside from Kickstarter. They got $400,000 on Kickstarter, which allowed them to make the film. And Rosa Tran, Duke Johnson, Charlie Kaufman, sorry, Duke Johnson, it is not Duke Jones, sorry, and Dino Stamatopoulos, they all acted as producers for the film. The screenplay is originally by Charlie Kaufman, and it is, as I said, based on Anomalisa, the stage play, which is by Charlie Kaufman. And Charlie Kaufman has done amazing stuff in the past. This is one of those ones that is very much the darling of the indie film scene, right? It went onto the indie circuit, and it started getting attention from everywhere. It's critically acclaimed, but it hasn't been commercially successful. And I'm actually really glad that Curse on Artificial Eye are putting this out, because it's one of those rare animated films. If it was a live-action film, it would be kind of middle-of-the-road romantic drama about a middle-aged guy who's having a bit of a midlife crisis, probably played by Adam Sandler in one of his in one of his attempted comedy roles, you know, to try and inject some humor.
By that, but, do you mean if,
but most likely,
if something like Universal picked it up and tried to do it?
Yeah,
do you mean if they just changed the medium?
Well, the thing is, it'd probably be played by Adam Sandler, but would be better done, I hate to say it, but would actually be done better by Ben Stiller. I hate to say it, but Ben Stiller would probably be much better at playing the role of Michael Stone than Adam Sandler, who attempts to overact everything. I mean, this is more like The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, but with less of the feel-good factor in terms of the story. The acting is amazing, right? David Thewlis is great as Michael, and Jennifer Jason Leigh is great as Lisa Hasselman, who's basically a sweet, friendly person who enjoys talking to Michael, and Michael enjoys listening to Lisa. Tom Noonan plays everybody else in this film, right?
Why not?
So there's only really three voice actors, and that's one of the amazing things about it. It's stop-motion animated. It's made on a very tight budget. It's amazing that they made this film, because it took 3 years to make, and each animator basically had to do like 48 frames a day to make the film. It's only got three voice actors. It's only got three voices in there. But they really make it stretch. They really make it work. And it's so beautifully put together. It's so beautifully produced. It's so beautifully shot. The settings, the cinematography, the animation, the character designs, the clothing, the lighting, everything. There's so much attention to detail. It's such a vibrant stop-motion animated world that's basically holds up this mirror to the real world. It's a little bit urban fantasy, a little bit romantic drama. It's a little bit of many things, but ultimately it's something that if you're a fan of animation, then really you should give it a try, especially if you're... This is the kind of thing that I want to see more of, because it's animation meant for a mature audience. It's animation meant for adults who actually want a decent story and who actually don't want to be patronized by, you know, in-jokes from Pixar and Disney and stuff like that. We want something solid that we can sink our teeth into.
You mean like Western animation?
Western animation, yeah. I'd love to see more of this sort of thing in Western animation. This is the kind of thing that if it was taken over to Japan and Korea and China, would actually cause a storm. You know, if they took it over to Japan and China and Korea, this would go, they would eat this up. They would merchandise the crap out of this, because it is so good and so well done. And I'm amazed that
sounds
they
pretty
made
anime
the move.
In a way, actually, from how you described it.
Well, the
by
style,
that, I mean the kind of story that it's telling, and
that's
like,
what I mean.
And how
yeah.
it's sort of showing you things rather than telling you, as you said, like when his face sort of falls off.
Yeah.
It's obviously significant, but it's not like, oh, this is happening and here's why. It's
well,
just
this is the thing.
It's just the events, and you make your own interpretation of it based on what's around it. It's a very anime way of telling a story.
Well, that's just storytelling 101. You know,
yeah, but you don't see it in.
you see it in thing is, you see it in films. You don't see it in Western animation.
Yeah.
But you see it a lot in films. And this first and foremost,
all right.
Yeah, this first and foremost is a movie.
From my experience, they tend to monologue. their feelings a lot in films, but that's just me.
It depends on what films you're watching.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're watching more of the
indie
films... I'm
talking about the films that are commercially successful.
Yeah, yeah, if you're talking about your Michael...
These are the good films that we're supposed to watch as people.
No. If you're talking about your Michael Bay's and stuff like that, then yeah.
I'm kind of talking about Michael Bay's. Not necessarily Michael Bay stuff and stuff quite as egregious as
Zack Snyder.
But just, I mean, anything that has that sort of target audience. And, you know, let's be honest, that's what people watch.
The thing is, that's the problem. That's the problem because Anomalisa isn't aimed at that target audience. Yeah. Anomalisa is aimed at people like me.
You just need more media like this in general. That's my opinion.
Anomalisa is aimed at people like me, people who actually love animation in general. It doesn't matter whether it's Western cartoons, Eastern cartoons. Doesn't matter. You know, I love stop motion. I love puppetry. I love anime. I love CG animation. I love it all.
Mm.
I think that animation is such an amazing medium because you literally can tell any story using animation. And I think that it's only really Korea and China and Japan who are pushing the boundaries of storytelling when it comes to animation.
Well, yeah, that's what I sort of mean. I mean, because like even some of the worser stuff, like Sword Art Online, for all its plot holes and, you know, what problems that it has, it still has a similar sort of way of telling a story relative to...
Yeah, but the thing is, anime does a lot of fantastical stuff, but the problem anime has is when it comes to mature storylines for... people like me. So your Asagi Drops, your Kids on the Slope, those sorts of stories where it's very much grounded in reality. So that's
I see what I mean. You mean stories based on real life?
Stories based on real life where you
can see what you mean. They're not that common. Yeah. I'll give you that.
At least they're the ones that make it feel like real life.
Yeah, because I was going to say Catherine, which is a game, but then that has a fantastic element to it. So
the thing is, the fantastic element in Catherine was downplayed quite a lot. You know,
that's true. It was downplayed.
Yeah, it was downplayed quite a lot and reduced to dreams. So it actually worked to a degree. But if you look at something like Usagi Drop, you know, Usagi Drop is very much, you know, in the here and now.
Mm.
It's very much a story that could work as a live action movie or a live action TV series or anything like that.
Mm.
And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, where you have a story that can work as a live action movie or as a live-action TV series, or as, you know, a book, or a comic, or a manga, or an anime. It could work in any of those media easily and equally and just be just as successful in all of them. Anomalisa is one of those where it could have been done by people, by actors. Mm. It really could have been played by actors. But if it had been done by actors, I think that this would have just been a middle-of-the-road romantic drama.
Mm.
I don't think it would have been anywhere near as special.
So I guess that's just my one question. When I was saying, like, do you mean that it'd be middle of the road because of how that sort of medium is approached, or is it just because it looks different, it wouldn't be the same?
I think it's just because...
it was exactly the same without...
The story itself is just a middle of the road romantic drama.
Oh,
right?
All right.
About a guy who's going through a bit of a midlife crisis and having a bit of a nervous breakdown.
Mm.
And has a one-night stand with a woman called Lisa.
I don't
know.
I mean, maybe I'm inexperienced in these sort of areas in terms of like media, but I haven't really heard of too many stories like that.
I've seen it to the point that people's faces fall off,
but that's just me.
Yeah, the whole addition of a bit of surrealism is one of the twists to it. But the actual foundation story, the basic plot, I've probably seen about 20-odd movies that have a very similar plot.
Yeah, I guess I can see what you mean, yeah.
And that's what I mean. If it was live action, it'd just be kind of middle-of-the-road romantic drama. The fact that it's stop-motion animated and so beautifully stop-motion animated, the fact that it had a small team, they had a small budget, there's only 3 voice actors, all of these things make it an absolute darling of the indie circuit. It's an absolute darling of the critics as well.
The critics absolutely
love this film because of not so much because of what it is, but because of what it represents.
Right.
You take stop motion animation.
Sort of shift.
It's a massive tonal shift in animation, as animation is perceived in the West. This is something that never existed before, and through the passion and hard work of the people behind it, they've created something actually really special. I love it. I really do. Okay, the story is middle of the road, but the presentation is phenomenal. The design, the acting, the artwork, the cinematography, everything is beautiful. It's one of those ones that If you're a fan of animation, I recommend you watch it. Obviously, it is aimed at a more mature audience. Anomaly set, I think it's a 15 rating here in the UK, and that's about right, I'd say, for it. If you're a fan of animation and you're over 15, watch it, seriously. And I don't mean if you're an anime fan, right? I mean if you're just a fan of animation. If you're doing animation at university or at college, it's one of those movies that I would absolutely recommend you watch. Because if you're doing animation, then you obviously have an interest in animation. And watching a movie like this is one of those things that is a real eye-opener for anybody who is into animation in general. If you're into anime, I'd say, yes, watch it. Give it a chance. Because most anime fans that I deal with and that I've met, they'll watch anime, but they won't give Western animation a chance. You understand exactly what I mean.
I understand, kind of, because it's not that I won't give Western animation a chance, but I'm one of those people who's like, but I like anime.
The thing is, I get it. There are some interesting things out there in Western animation, and that's why I encourage people to explore animation in general rather than just anime. Anyway, yeah, that's Anomalisa. So we're done for the day, I think. We've covered three shows.
It's quite a lot.
For us, yeah, I know. So we're going to love you and leave you for this week, and we'll be back next week with more shows and more stuff and more of everything. In the meantime, the Geek Show Podcast Network is a volunteer organization, so show your support, make a donation, buy something from our shop. Everything is there on thegeekshow.co.uk. You can get in touch with us direct, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, MyAnimeList, and various places on the internet. All of our shows are available on Mixcloud, iTunes, Stitcher. Anyway, I have been Rob.
I've been Tucky.
And I've been Lewis.
And you've been very quiet, Tucky.
I know.
You're reading stuff.
I'm learning.
Okay, we'll see you all next week.
Stay with us for the next episode. Good night, everyone.